The subcommittee will now come to order. Good morning and welcome to today's hearing on an issue that is very important to all of us. I'm pleased to have assembled with the help of Ranking Member Mr. Michaud the panel we have in front of us here today. As most of you here today know, much has been written and discussed relative to post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, since the beginning of Operation Enduring and Iraqi Freedom. We are fortunate to have before us some of those who are responsible for providing us critical data on those mental health conditions, and I am eager to take this opportunity to learn more about the nature of the disorder and the prevalence among our returning servicemen and women. And while PTSD seems to have captured a majority of the headlines over the last few years, an equal challenging condition is being seen in increasing number at the VA, traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Due to the concussion nature of many of the war-related injuries being seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, TBI can take many forms, ranging from quite mild, almost undetectable, to very dramatic. We will be interested in hearing how the VA is meeting the increased demands, how the four polytrauma centers are handling that workload, and what best practices are being shared with other VA medical centers to ensure that the best care is being provided all around the nation for those who have suffered some form of TBI. In addition, we are going to examine some of the similarities between PTSD and TBI in terms of how the conditions manifest, how they are identified, and ultimately how they are treated. The important point I would like to add to this is that these injured service members, in particular those with PTSD, can be treated and a sense of normalcy can be attained. Having said that, in the absence of an in-theater risk mitigation technique, effective early identification and aggressive outreach and treatment, normalcy and appropriate adjustments may be difficult to realize for some returning from the theater. This is an important topic, and I want to thank those assembled before us today for taking the time to help us better understand some of the emerging health challenges that both DOD and VA will continue to face. And now I yield the Ranking Member Mr. Michaud for an opening statement.
Thank you very much, Chairman Brown, for holding this very important oversight hearing. Fatalities to our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan from blast-related injuries are lower than previous conflicts due to improved protective combat equipment and advances in the delivery of medicine on the battlefield. However, those who survive blasts are at great risk with traumatic brain injury or TBI. Severe, moderate, and even mild TBI can affect veterans and their families for the rest of their lives. Brain injuries can impair functions, including short-term memory, concentration, judgment, as well. Many TBI cases experience degrees of impaired vision. In an effort of veterans and also affect the veterans' ability to return to work. The emotional and behavioral changes that result from TBI can place a tremendous burden on family and friends. Many veterans with mild TBI may have their symptoms misdiagnosed as a mental health disorder. These veterans need targeted care to help them function better. Post-traumatic stress disorder is also a wound that many of our returning veterans carry home. Unfortunately, the stigma of mental illness often leads veterans to ignore or deny that they had any problems, even when they see their relationship and lives crumble under the weight of the symptoms of PTSD. Untreated PTSD is linked with substance abuse, severe depression, and unfortunately, even suicide. Sadly, we have already seen too many Vietnam veterans and now veterans from Iraq go down this tragic path. Access to VA mental health programs and TBI programs and the quality of these programs depend on adequate funding. VA mental health care experts have recognized that VA's programs has gaps in quality. In response, Secretary Principe rightly adopted a mental health strategy plan with initiatives to address the gap in VA's mental health care efforts. The administration promised to commit $100 million in fiscal year 2005 and $200 million in fiscal year 2006 to fund these mental health care initiatives. Last fall, Ranking Member Lane Evans and I asked GAO to study whether the administration fulfilled this commitment to fund the new mental health initiatives. Today, GAO's testimony provides is preliminary findings on that study. And sadly, the administration is far short of fulfilling its commitment. VA did not provide $100 million in fiscal year 2005 with new mental health care efforts. VA only funded approximately $53 million. VA claimed to GAO that it also provided $35 million in funds generally distributed to VA hospitals and clinics. GAO found, and VA concedes, that VA never told medical facility directors that the $35 million was to be used to rebuild mental health services. GAO also found that some of the $53 million went unspent. The preliminary findings for fiscal year 2006 were also disappointing. VA allocated, at best, $158 million of the promised $200 million. Again, GAO found that some of this money might not be spent. Gaps in mental health care services remained. The mental health strategic plan is good. However, without real commitment to funding, the plan will not become a reality. Members on both sides of the aisle want and need to address this very important issue. We must keep our promise to our veterans and dedicate mental health care staff who want to help them to recover from psychological wounds of the war. Funding and implementation of VA's mental health plans will require vigorous oversight from this committee, and that is why I am pleased, Mr. Chairman, that we are holding this hearing. And further, it is my intention to continue to press for passage of Lane Evans' comprehensive PTSD bill, H.R. 1588. It is also my intention to reintroduce an updated version of this legislation in Lane Evans' name in the 110th Congress to ensure that his noble efforts are carried on in order to meet the critical mental health challenges that we face. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you very much. And I also like to welcome both Representative Pasquale and Representative Boswell. And I want to thank Chairman Brown for allowing them to join us at this hearing, because I know they have a deep commitment to veterans' issues, and that they definitely will add a lot to this discussion. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
And I know, I thank you, Mr. Michaud, for your opening statement. And I know both of those gentlemen are from other committees, and they got other responsibilities. So if it's the will of the committee to allow them to speak out of order and to speak for 2 minutes without objection. Okay, Mr. Pasquale.
I get some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ranking Member Michaud, and all subcommittee members for dedicating so much of your time to this very critical issue. I salute the Veterans Committee. And your work many times goes unnoticed. I understand that. I'd like to ask that my entire testimony be inserted into the record, if you would.
Without objection.
As a co-founder of the Congressional Brain Injury Task Force, I'm committed to improving the lives of individuals with traumatic brain injury, TBI. I'd like to focus on an issue that has gained more and more publicity over the last year, traumatic brain injury in our nation's servicemen and women, past and present. Traumatic brain injury is defined as a blow or jolt of the head or a penetrating head injury that disrupts the function of the brain. This has been called the silent epidemic. 1,500,000 people are affected in the United States every year. When I first learned of this 7 years ago, I want to tell you, Mr. Chairman, I was just shocked out of my wits. I never thought, until folks in my own district came to me, you know, we need to be educated on these things, and certainly members of Congress should be, so if we're going to talk about it. Military duties increase the risk of sustaining TBI. For our armed forces, TBI is an important clinical problem in peace and war, and its consequences may extend for many years. Over 1,500 military personnel involved in the global war on terror have been seen and treated by DVBIC. At Walter Reed alone, over 650 soldiers with brain injuries from Iraq and Afghanistan have been treated. That represents 40% of all the troops evacuated to Walter Reed Medical Center so far. About 10% of the service members in Iraq, 20% of the troops on the front lines return from combat tours with concussions. That has to set in to me. Emphasis is for me. DVBIC, the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center, was established in 1992 after a Desert Storm. Until then, there was no overall systematic program for providing brain injury-specific care and rehab within the Department of Defense or the Veterans Administration, for that matter. The changing nature of warfare demands corresponding improved and specialized medical care. It has been estimated that 50% of all combat injuries are blast injuries. So as part of the recently passed Blast Injury Prevention, Mitigation, and Treatment Initiative, the DVBIC is leading the effort to illuminate patterns of brain injury from blasts, including providing guidelines for the assessment. I must say, Mr. Chairman, the last 5 years, there's been more advancement in this area than probably in the past couple of hundred years, so that parts of the brain that have not been affected in a negative way can be developed so that we can compensate. These are great times. I tell kids in the schools, don't let your parents tell you, oh, for the good old days. These are the times when we can address these very serious injuries in terms of modern warfare. The Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center's mission is to serve active duty military, their dependents and veterans with TBI, to state-of-the-art medical care, innovative clinical research initiatives, and educational programs. In order to better recognize TBI, the DVBIC has begun to employ improved diagnostics, increased brain injury training of battlefield medics, and clinical research on blast injury. Now, what I want to emphasize in concluding, Mr. Chairman, is the need to improve and expand. The Special Committee on Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and the Committee on Care of Veterans with Serious Mental Illness recommended to the Veterans Administration under the Secretary of Health that VA establish a screening process to identify veterans with mild TBI. I recommend that we look into that screening process. Also noted was the need for the VA to establish a TBI registry that can be used to create more sophisticated evidence-based cost-effective assessment and treatment strategies. We've passed general legislation to do this throughout the nation for civilian TBI. We need to do it in terms of the special situation that we face as Americans. In July 2006, the Veterans Administration Inspector General's Office reported on a lack of consistency in VA case management, citing that the effectiveness of case managers ranged from outstanding to inadequate. The Inspector General also reported on the major weakness in the VA's TBI care and its participation in the DVBIC program. The number of TBI beds, and I was shocked to find this out, and head injury and head brain injury treatment resources do not correspond to the scope of the problem. That was the case since 1999. It's the case today also. And very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I would ask you, beg you to look at the funding. According to a recent study by the researchers at Harvard and Columbia, the cost of medical treatment for individuals with TBI from the Iraq War will at least cost $14 billion over the next 20 years. This is a sustaining situation and not going to be a hit or miss. Without our support, DVBIC's congressionally directed mission of coordinating clinical health, clinical care, executing research that will result in better characterization and management of the problem, and education to both military and civilian communities will come to a halt. This is one of TBI Task Force's primary missions. As such, in conclusion, the task force, along with other concerned members, request an additional $12 million for the DVBIC in the Military Quality of Life and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill for fiscal year 2007 for a total of $19 million. I know the committee shares these sentiments, and I am absolutely thankful for the fact that you've let me testify.
Well, let me also thank you, Ms. Pascoe, for taking your time to be part of this discussion. We've got assembled a great panel that I'm sure has listened very intently to some of your recommendations, and thank you for coming. You can stay for the whole meeting if you'd like.
Thank you.
But we wanted to afford you the opportunity to speak first. And Mr. Boswell, if you could take a couple of minutes so we can proceed.
I heard the couple of minutes, and I'll try to do that, sir. And I do thank you kindly, you and Mr. Mashoud, for allowing us to do this. As Congressman Pascrell has already said, very kind of you. I've been respecting your work on this for a long time, and I salute you too, sir, because I know your heart's in this and you're focused, and we can't thank you enough. There's probably over 100 of us here in this room and otherwise that are veterans, and so we thank you. I feel very fortunate. I might share with you before I start, I have a veteran that's from Iraq that's on my staff, and I'd like to introduce you to this veteran. She's standing right over there, Alexis Taylor. She joined my staff, an Iraq veteran.
Glad to have you with us today.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I would say this, that we all know it's been said that more and more veterans are returning from tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's many new issues. We heard some of them. But it's an issue I don't think we can ignore, and I'm not suggesting that we are. The number of veterans returning with post-traumatic stress disorder is alarmingly high. A recent study found that 17% of soldiers and Marines returning from Iraq screened positive for PTSD. Our men and women in uniform returning from combat are fighting a different type of war and a different type of enemy. I thought maybe I had seen it all in Vietnam, as it was different. There's no front line there either. I helped put too many of our young men and women in body bags, and it makes a lasting impression. The National Center for PTSD found several things associated with individuals diagnosed with PTSD, such as physical pain, sleep disturbance, nightmares, substance abuse, self-harm, or suicide. I believe, obviously, there is a connection between PTSD and suicide. Some estimates have found that almost 1,000 veterans receiving care from the Department of Veterans Affairs commit suicide each year. And research shows that 1 out of 100 veterans who have returned from Iraq have considered suicide. I find this very disturbing. Since March of 2003, 80 individuals who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan have committed suicide. Our young men and women serve our country have kept us safe for so long. It's our job, as you know, to protect them. A few months ago, I learned of a young man from my district, Joshua Omvig, who experienced undiagnosed PTSD after returning from an 11-month tour in Iraq. His family and friends did not know how to help him. Goodness knows they tried. Then in December of last year, Joshua tragically took his life. He was only 22 years old. His parents were very close. They knew something wasn't right, and they were trying everything they could think of. He was staying with them and going to work and trying to get adjusted. And one morning, his mother felt the intensity, and she stayed right with him as he went out to get in his pickup to go to work, and he shot himself in front of his mother in the pickup. After I heard his story, I was shocked to find 1 in 100 Operation Iraqi Freedom veterans have reported thinking about suicide. I knew something had to be done, as anybody would feel. That is why we've introduced the 5771, the Joshua Omvig Veteran Suicide Prevention Act. This legislation will mandate the Department of Veterans Affairs to develop and implement a comprehensive program to regularly screen and monitor all veterans for risk factors for suicide within the Veterans Affairs system. At any point in a veteran's life, if they were found to have specific risk factors for suicide, they would be entered into a tracking system, ensuring they do not fall through the cracks. Then they would be entered into a counseling referral system to make certain those veterans receive the appropriate help. It would provide education for all VA staff, contractors, medical personnel who have interaction with the veterans. In addition, it would make available 24-hour mental health care for veterans found to be at risk for suicide. Currently, the Department of Veterans Affairs regularly screens veterans for depression, PTSD, and substance abuse, but not suicide specifically. I am saddened by the circumstances that this legislation grew out of, but I know that if enacted, this program could save lives. We treat their physical injuries, with goodness knows we should, and now it's time to treat their wounds that are not visible. It's my hope that a comprehensive veterans bill will result from this hearing, that any bill considered will include provisions for the Joshua Omvig Veteran Suicide Prevention Act. This important issue cannot go another day without the attention it needs. And, Mr. Chairman, I say this, and I'm looking you square in the eye, and I'm very, very serious. It's not important to Leonard Boswell to have my name on that bill. It's not. We're in the political season, and we know that. It is important that this need be taken care of, and I would be delighted if you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michaud, wanted to take this and make it your bill. I don't care. I know there is a need, and I think we all know that. And that is the way I deeply feel about it. It unfortunately came to my attention the manner it did. We've stayed very close to the family, very close. When we developed this idea, we went and talked to them about it because they've come out, in a sense. They want to help others. They're in their grief and their shock, and they'll go on the rest of their lives. But they want to do something to help others. And so we felt like we could, so very carefully, very quietly, I went and talked to them with staff that was working on it and said, this is what we had in mind. What would they think about it? And after a few tears, they said, this would be wonderful. I said, now, it's up to you. If allowed, I would name this the Josh Omvig Bill. And they looked at each other, and they said they would be honored. So that's the reason it's on there. And I seriously don't care who gets credit for sponsoring this bill. I want you to know that, Mr. Chairman. I say this with all sincerity. It needs action, and I have confidence that you and Mike will give it your attention. And I thank you very, very much for allowing me to make this testimony, and I'll leave this for the record.
Well, and certainly if you would, with that unanimous consent, to allow that to submit to the records will be fine, Ms. Bob. And I really do appreciate you, Mr. Pascal, coming and being a part of this discussion. This has been a committee hearing. It's been late coming, and I'm grateful for y'all's input.
Thank you.
I know we all got stories we can tell about personal involvement. I know last July I had my appendix taken out, and you know, Bethesda on the fifth floor, and had a chance to interact for about 4 or 5 days for those young men and women coming back from harm's way, and you know, you could see some visible injuries. You know, some of them came back without an arm or a leg, and those were easily identifiable. And I went in the room for this young guy from Florence, South Carolina, who had had half of his skull actually blown away, and they got the computer technology to replace the image of that skull, and they all could draft, you know, hair on it to make it kind of look back like it was normal. But you could tell that you looked at that young man's eyes and you talked to him that you knew that he was going to have a lasting problem with that brain injury. And so this is a major concern, and we're grateful for y'all's input. And you can stay as long as you like, if you like. And
thank you for what you've just said. And, you know, with today's technology, we do the battery tests when the young men and women leave the service. We got the ability to see what's going on in their minds, and we just got to do something about it. And we thank you. We wouldn't ever think of not doing something for the physical injury.
Right.
As you well know, we would do everything we possibly could, and the mental injury is just as important.
That's right. Thank you so much. And our ranking member, active ranking member, would you like to do you have an opening statement?
Yeah, I'd like to submit my opening statement for the record. Let me just thank Mr. Pascrell and Mr. Boswell, not only for your expertise, but for your passion. We need that energy. And I would say to the panel something I generally say after you've all testified. Please don't hide behind statistics and bureaucraties and written statements. Let us know that you have some passion for doing this too, for solving this issue. I think we want to hear that more than anything else, than any defensiveness about what you're doing, about any things that you want to point out. We want to make sure that you have the passion that many of us have from personal experiences, and I know you all do too, but not only it's in these committee hearings that doesn't always come out. And let me say, I think we're letting our veterans down today. The young men and women who are, as you showed one of us here, Mr. Boswell, coming back are the bravest young people in the world. And yet, we're not giving them the attention or the expertise that we have as a society. We don't do outreach sufficiently. We don't make sure that the mental, as has been said here, is seen as important as the physical. The mental scars will last probably longer, or at least equally, and may have a deeper impact. And yet, when these young men and women come back, they don't even know what they got. And when we have diagnoses of PTSD, the first thing the VA does, instead of saying we got to have more facilities and more resources to deal with it, the first thing to do is investigate why we have so many diagnoses of PTSD. That's disgraceful, that's the response that these young men and women get, and the doctors who are dealing with them. And the tragedy, as I think both of our guests have said, we know how to deal with these issues today better than we ever have. And we watch the same thing for these returning Iraqi vets that we saw in Vietnam when we knew less. They come home without knowledge of what's going on. The family doesn't have any idea. There's violence in the family, perhaps, spousal abuse, kids get run away, alcohol and drug abuse, loss of job, homelessness, suicide. I think the figures are that I've seen, Mr. Pascrell, are much higher. I see figures of several hundred suicides and a much higher rate, as you point out, than either in the general veterans population or in the general population. This is a tragedy. The administration says, support our troops, support our troops, support our troops. But when they come home, we don't have the outreach for them, we don't have the resources for them. We know that whatever percentage it is, whether it's half or a third of our veterans that have PTSD, we don't have the resources to deal with it. I've been at the PTSD clinics in San Diego. They are wonderful. We know how to deal with it, but we don't know how to get, we're not getting all the people in that need it. And we're not given the resources to make sure that we can handle them if we did. We even have now, as I think you point out, ways to perhaps genetic, or I should say, knowledge of the brain that says this is, we can physically identify who has certainly a high risk of PTSD. So let us, as a nation, commit ourselves. We made a tremendous moral mistake by not dealing with these issues for Vietnam. It's not too late, by the way. Half of the homeless on the street tonight are probably Vietnam vets, probably with intense mental situations. We need to bring them back if we can. But let us not lose more of returning from Iraq to this terrible situation. So we want to give you all the resources that you need as professionals. But we have to look at this in a passionate way, like our two guests have shown. And we have to, as a nation, say, we are going to support our troops. We're going to treat these mental illnesses with the knowledge that we have, and we are not going to let them be lost to further contributions to our society. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Phil. Do you have an opening statement? Okay, thank you very much. Well, we're absolutely impressed that we got such an outstanding panel before us today, and let me introduce our panel. I welcome Dr. Gerald Cross, the acting principal deputy under secretary for health at the VA, and he is accompanied by Dr. Katz, the deputy chief patient care service officer for mental health, and Dr. Siegfried, VA's national program director for physical medicine and rehabilitation. Representing the United States Army, we are pleased to have Colonel Elsep Cameron Ritchie and Colonel Charles W. Hogue. Dr. Ritchie is the psychiatrist consultant to the Surgeon General of the United States Army, and Dr. Hogue is the director of the Division of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And they're accompanied by Colonel Labota, the chief of the Department of Neurosurgery at Walter Reed. We will now proceed with Dr. Cross.
I'm accompanied by Dr. Ira Katz, Chief Patient Services Officer for Mental Health, and Dr. Barbara Siegfried, Director of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Service. And first, let me say, I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, we from VHA do have passion, and we have that passion in caring for our veterans. I'd like to submit my written testimony for the record. In beginning my testimony, I would like to address an issue that I know is of concern to many members. Recently, VA's Inspector General issued a report on our ability to care for patients with traumatic brain injuries. While the report identifies areas in which we can improve on our performance, its executive summary is very clear. It states that our patients have very similar outcomes when compared with a matched group of TBI patients from the private sector. Given that our patients have more severe injuries than the average patient, and given that it takes longer for them to begin rehabilitation because of the complexity of their wounds, and because of the distance they must travel from the theater of war to begin treatment for those wounds, the fact that our patients do as well as those in the private sector demonstrates that we are doing an outstanding job in supporting their recovery and that we are providing the exceptional care Congress and all Americans expect of our department. VA is succeeding in treating many TBI patients with multidisciplinary approaches that include a sensitivity to the physical, cognitive, emotional, functional, and behavioral manifestations of brain trauma. Our polytrauma system of care includes four primary polytrauma rehabilitation centers, which provide exemplary care for veterans with multiple injuries, including brain injuries, and fully involves their families in their care and treatment. 21 new polytrauma network sites are opening this fall, enhancing access and ensuring lifelong coordination of care for these men and women, and a hotline for all polytrauma patients and their families is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. To ensure that we identify every veteran with TBI, VA clinicians are receiving additional training in recognizing both acute and delayed symptoms of brain trauma, and in providing the prompt identification and multidisciplinary evaluation and treatment, which are essential for their successful recovery. We are improving our ability to coordinate the care of TBI patients by assigning a permanent social worker case manager to every patient we have seen at our polytrauma centers. And we recognize the need for family support in caring for loved ones. Our intent is to restore every patient to his or her fullest possible level of functioning. We will not fail in that effort. Mr. Chairman, members are also concerned that we have the capacity and the funds to treat OIF-OEF veterans with PTSD. Let me assure the committee that we do. Among our accomplishments, we have been adding 100 OIF-OEF veterans to our Vet Center staff to provide clinical peer support. We have expended substantial funds to expand mental health services at our community-based outpatient clinics, and we have added telemental health services to serve remote locations. Altogether, VHA now operates approximately 200 specialized PTSD programs, in addition to our 207 vet centers, which, by the way, will increase in number to 209 by October of this year. Working closely with our colleagues in DOD and other federal agencies, our researchers are working on new pharmacological, psychological, and other treatments, and we are finding ways to harness these technologies to extend our ability to care for veterans with this illness. And we are placing a special emphasis on finding more effective ways to treat veterans, including women veterans, at risk for PTSD. Mr. Chairman, today's veterans with PTSD and TBI are receiving state-of-the-art care throughout VHA. We are committed to improving our abilities to address TBI and PTSD and to meet the specific needs of veterans returning from the global war on terror who have earned and are receiving the best care available anywhere. Thank you for your time, sir.
I'm sure glad I gave that lecture on passion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, General, for being a part of this, and thank you for your passion and for your understanding and for your expertise. And with that, I'll ask Colonel Ritchie to testify.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members, Mr. Michaud, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to share with you our concern and our passion about taking care of our soldiers and veterans. Going to war affects all soldiers. The number of soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, has gradually risen. Since 9/11, the Army Medical Department has taken care of soldiers at the Pentagon during 9/11, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and throughout the world. We take care of soldiers with physical wounds and with the psychological issues from combat. We are committed to providing and ensuring that all returning veterans receive the physical and behavioral health care they need. An extensive array of mental health services has long been available. However, since 9/11, we've augmented and improved behavioral health services throughout the world, especially at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and the other power projection platforms and major Army installations where we mobilize, train, deploy, and demobilize Army forces. We anticipate that the need for these services will not decrease. We are committed to providing the necessary help. The Army Medical Department has performed behavioral health surveillance in an unprecedented manner. There have been 4 mental health advisory teams, 3 previously in Iraq, 1 in Afghanistan, and currently 1 in Iraq at this time. Colonel Hogue will present his research. We've also performed several epidemiological consultations called EPICONs at installations in the United States, such as the assessment following the cluster of suicide homicides at Fort Bragg in North Carolina in 2002. There are numerous other initiatives for us to learn from the war. We held a workshop on updates in combat psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in 2004, where we gathered together those who had been in theater with academicians and policymakers. We've used the results of all of these assessments to improve the behavioral health services that we offer our soldiers. The Army Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel and the Army Surgeon General share responsibility for the prevention and screening for PTSD for soldiers, both active and reserve, from the global war on terror. Derived partly from the EPICON results from Fort Bragg, we have come up with a new deployment cycle support program that's been in place for several years to help our soldiers and their families. Since the beginning of the war, there's been a robust combat and operational stress control presence in theater. Today, more than 200 behavioral health providers are deployed in Iraq and another 25 in Afghanistan. The mental health assessment team reports have demonstrated both of the successes and some of the limitations of these combat stress control teams. As a result of learning of the limitations, we have improved the distribution of behavioral health providers throughout the theater. Access to care and quality of care have improved as a result. Before deployment, soldiers are screened for medical issues, including family problems. Then, as part of the reintegration process, soldiers are briefed on what stressors to expect, the common symptoms of post-deployment stress, such as hyperarousal, and ways to mitigate these symptoms. The post-deployment health assessment when soldiers are coming home, is used to screen the soldiers again for physical complaints and psychological complaints. And then last year, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs directed an extension of the current program so that we now have a post-deployment health reassessment. And the Army requires that all soldiers redeployed from a combat zone, whether they're active or reserve, complete this new PDHRA screen at 3 to 6 months following deployment. The PDHRA program was fully implemented in January of 2006. If a soldier has post-traumatic stress disorder or other psychological difficulties, they will be further evaluated and treated using well-recognized treatment guidelines, including psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy. Traumatic brain injury is also a focus of our attention. TBI, as it's often called, is a broad grouping of injuries that range from mild concussions to penetrating head wounds. Many of these symptoms are similar to post-traumatic stress disorder, especially the symptoms of difficulty concentrating and irritability. I have Colonel Labuda here, Chief of Neurology, with me today to answer any questions you may have on screening, diagnosis, and treatment of TBI. We recognize that there's a perceived stigma. Therefore, we're moving to integrate behavioral health care into primary care wherever possible. Our pilot program at Fort Bragg, Respect.mil, has been very successful, and we are moving to implement it throughout the Army. There's legitimate concern about our isolated reserve component soldiers. The Army One Source program was put into place and has now become the military One Source to provide free confidential counseling. Our physically wounded soldiers have also been the focus of attention. Finally, we have been working on improving our suicide prevention programs. Every suicide is a tragedy. The DESPER is a proponent for suicide prevention, while the chaplains conduct suicide prevention classes, and behavioral health is also doing surveillance. However, several years ago, we leveraged a new report, the Army Suicide Event Report, to ACER to improve our surveillance. All suicides and serious suicide attempts require this report to be filled out, and we are in the process of setting up a new suicide prevention office within the Army Medical Department. So continuing, we continue to assess the quality of our services. We learn. Lieutenant General Kiley is a co-chair of the Department of Defense Mental Health Task Force with a report due in May of 2007. We're ongoing training of our leadership in numerous venues. You have already heard about after the soldier leaves and goes to the VA, it's critically important also that we provide education to our civilian providers, that they learn to ask, are you a veteran and have you been exposed to a blast injury? And we have numerous efforts. In summary, we have been at war for 5 years. War challenges the psychological health of our troops and their families. We have been in continual process of improving our efforts. This is not just an Army issue. It's not just a VA issue. It's a national issue. We have the tools that we need to recognize and treat soldiers and their families. Thank you very much for your attention.
And I thank you, Colonel Richard, for your service. And this time we'll hear from Colonel Hoag.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members. Thank you for inviting me here. I direct a research program focused on assuring that soldiers who serve in Iraq and Afghanistan get the best mental health services that we can provide. And since my testimony to this committee in July of 2005, we've continued to collect data and continued to try to refine our programs and improve our programs based on the lessons learned from the data that we've collected. Soldiers are remarkably resilient. They are doing heroic things day after day for a year or longer. Some of them are going back for their second or third rotation. They're working in highly dangerous and unpredictable environments. And it's normal to experience symptoms after these combat experiences. Most soldiers transition very well when they come home and have resolution of those symptoms. Some need help. And that's been the primary focus of the research that we've been conducting. Based on the data from several sources, and we now have robust data from a number of different sources, we estimate that 10 to 15% of Army soldiers develop post-traumatic stress disorder after deployment to Iraq, and another 10 to 15% have significant symptoms of PTSD, depression, or generalized anxiety and may benefit from care. Alcohol and family problems can add to these concerns. The Army has a comprehensive strategy to encourage soldiers to seek help early before these symptoms become severe or interfere with their lives, seriously interfere with their lives, such as the example that we heard earlier today. We learned that soldiers may not express mental health concerns until several months after they return from deployment, and as a result, the post-deployment health assessment now includes the reassessment that Dr. Ritchie discussed earlier. So far, over 60,000 soldiers who have returned from Iraq have completed this health assessment. Of these, 35% reported some sort of mental health concern on the general screening questions, and after speaking with a healthcare professional, about 18% were recommended to seek assistance from one of the many mental health sources of care. One new finding from the post-deployment health reassessment program is that reserve component soldiers, that is, National Guard and reservists, report higher rates of mental health concerns and have higher rates of referral compared to active component soldiers. It is important not to misinterpret these data as suggesting that they are in some way less mentally healthy than the active component soldiers. Reserve component and active component soldiers have nearly identical rates of mental health concerns in theater and immediately post-deployment, and these differences don't appear to emerge until several months after they've returned home. We don't know exactly why this is, but potential factors that could relate to this include concerns about ongoing access to health care among reserve component soldiers after they've been home for some period of time, and the fact that active component soldiers stay with their unit and they continue to work full-time with their unit, with the peers who they've shared their combat experiences with. And that provides a very supportive environment for resolving symptoms when they've been home. So far, we are not seeing higher rates of mental health concerns among soldiers who have deployed more than one time to Iraq compared with those who have deployed once. However, it's difficult to measure the effect of multiple deployments, because the rate of leaving military service is somewhat higher for those who've been to Iraq one time. Although we have data indicating that our efforts are working to encourage soldiers to get help for combat-related mental health problems, our surveys indicate that many soldiers with mental health concerns still don't seek care and perceive that they will be stigmatized if they do, that is, viewed or treated somehow differently by their peers or leaders. The data on stigma have led to new approaches to improve the availability of mental health in primary care settings and training for soldiers and leaders to improve their recognition of mental health issues, reduce the perception of stigma, and ensure a successful transitions throughout the deployment cycle. In the area of training, my team has developed and tested a new training program called Battle Mind with these goals in mind. This new training highlights the skills that help soldiers survive in combat and how to transition these skills when they get home. The training has been incorporated into the Army Deployment Cycle Support Program and is being utilized in a variety of ways, including at VA facilities and VA vet centers. Further information on these training materials can be obtained at www.battlemind.org. Thank you very much for your continued interest in our research and your support for the men and women who are serving in Iraq and have served in Iraq and Afghanistan and other locations.
And I thank you, sir, for your testimony and for your involvement in this program. My first question would be that, understanding that the post-deployment health assessment and the post-deployment health reassessment are self-reporting tools, are you personally convinced that they are powerful, sufficient to be used as predictable tools? And if not, how can they be improved? Either or both, if you would care to.
The post-deployment health assessment and post-deployment health reassessment include a self-report portion of the survey, but basically all individuals sit down with a primary care professional to review the answers that they put on those surveys. So, in essence, those survey questions are really just prompts to help the primary care professional identify what issues need to be discussed further.
If I may add to that, it is also important to recognize that the soldiers have a number of other venues to seek help, and we encourage the unit, and I believe the unit leaders are very much doing this, to provide outreach and education. And then there's a number of other efforts, such as the combat stress control teams, to provide outreach, education, and treatment if necessary.
I assume that all the young men and women leaving service are leaving the battlefield. They have this battery of tests or this observation. And I guess the ones that show signs, I guess they're sort of put in the system. But is there a process to later go back and reevaluate the ones that's not detected early on after they leave the battlefields to see if there's a later developing problem?
Sir, that is one of the main reasons that the post-deployment health reassessment was established, to be done 3 to 6 months after the soldier has returned from combat. I think it is very important that we have numerous opportunities in our system and in the VA system for the soldier to seek treatment, because we do recognize that many soldiers will not seek treatment right away.
And if I might ask, and how are the service of chaplains being integrated, into the theater-based assessment team? Do you bring the chaplains on board to help do the assessments?
If I understand the question correctly, you asked how the chaplains are integrated into theater and also after the return home.
I was just, my question is how they integrated in the assessment of the troops after they leave the battlefield.
Chaplains are an integral part of our system. In general, each battalion has its own chaplain who will work very closely to the soldiers, and this is extremely important because it provides a non-stigmatizing, confidential way for the soldier to seek help. Chaplains have also been part of our mental health assessment teams. In terms of after they come back, again, the chaplains will be present and in every battalion, and as a result of the evaluations, the post-deployment health assessment or reassessment, the soldier can either seek out a chaplain or a behavioral health provider. So again, they're very well integrated, and we really could not do our mission without them.
You have something to add, Dr. Hogue, on that? Do you have anything further to add on that question about the chaplains? Are you pretty satisfied?
I agree completely. They're very well integrated and very important part of the well-being of soldiers in every unit.
Okay. Thank you. We'll probably come back for some other questions, and I'll also offer the other members of the committee to question later, but let me further my question to Dr. Cross and Dr. Katz, if I could. One of the biggest challenges that we continue to hear a lot about is the transitional rehab capacity of VA for those with TBI. Dr. Cross, Dr. Katz, or Dr. Siegfried, please describe the resources available to our men and women after they have been discharged from a VA facility. Right.
Resources available after they separate from the military.
That's right. Yes.
For both PTSD and TBI, we have very significant programs available. I wanted to highlight particularly both in the programs that we have to address their needs and in outreach, our vet centers. Our vet centers are a unique resource within our organization, and I wanted to point out a couple of things about them. And as of August, counseled 16,933, outreach services for 111,000 plus, and also counseled with 1,215 families. A unique resource where the new veteran can just walk in, no wait, say hello, be welcome, say have a cup of coffee, take it easy, let's talk. And I think that's very important. We also have a comprehensive system of primary care. We're training our primary care providers to make sure that they understand, in addition to all of their other training, that they can recognize TBI, PTSD. We have put out this training manual and an online course that we now mandate for our primary care providers working with polytrauma patients and others. And, of course, our PTSD programs, 112 inpatient, over 200 specialty service programs. And I'll ask Dr. Katz to expand on that.
The first task is to overcome the barriers to veterans getting into our systems. For that, there are interactions with DOD. Dr. Botrys's vet centers are also very important sources of outreach. In our medical centers and clinics, we also run outreach programs. Over recent years, we funded 84 outreach providers to go out to the community, reserve, and guard units, and also to do inreach, to work with veterans in primary care, in rehabilitation programs after physical injury, to educate veterans and families about mental health conditions, and to give the message that treatment works. We're working very hard to get patients somewhere. The no wrong door theme that we've learned from the vet centers applies all over the system. Our goal is to get people in treatment, knowing that treatment works and that it can prevent disability.
Let me follow up on that if we could. And what type of collaborative arrangements exist with the DOD to provide a continued care for these folks? A September 2004 GAO report stated that VA lacks the information it needs to determine whether it can meet an increase in demand for VA PTSD services. VA stated that it planned to aggravate at the national level the number of veterans receiving PTSD services at VA medical facilities and vet centers and shared this information with GAO. Has this been achieved?
Sir, in regard to collaboration with DOD, we're making remarkable efforts in that area. We have put our own staff in the 8 military treatment facilities where returning service members are most likely to come. We're collaborating on information exchange to make sure that data that comes that is found, obtained in the DOD system, is conveyed over to us. I have observed personally an interaction between our Tampa facility for polytrauma, Walter Reed in Bethesda, talking about a patient online on video teleconference, simultaneously with a doctor in Baghdad who had actually treated that patient initially, a remarkable degree of communication.
Is that a seamless transfer of information, or is that a manual transfer of information? Do you have, like, is the computers compatible, and can you share those records electronically?
We're receiving electronic information from DOD, but we're also on a person case by patient by patient basis, making sure that we talk to each other to compare notes.
Okay.
And we're talking about the very, very seriously injured polytrauma patients.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Michelle, would you have some questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I want to thank the panel for your testimony. Colonel Hogue, your research shows real differences in how the National Guard members and reservists respond to PTSD screening questions 3 through 6, most after deployment, as compared to active components of service members. Is this because the National Guard and Reserve members do not have the same access to mental health services or support?
Sir, we're not really sure. This is the new data. The PDHRA program has just been implemented, and this is the first time that we've seen this. To date, all of our data has shown very comparable rates between active component and reserve component. So something's happening in terms of the level of concern rising in reserve component soldiers, among reserve component soldiers, after they've been home for several months. And I don't know if that's concern that they may have issues that may be ongoing, and whether they may have concerns that they're about getting health care on an ongoing basis. They also we have a relatively small sample of reserve component soldiers who have completed the post-deployment health reassessment, and that sample may not be representative of all reserve component soldiers. So this needs to be continued to be studied. We were asked specifically to, about what we're seeing on the PDHRA, and I felt like it was important to share those data, even though they are fairly preliminary.
Thank you. Dr. Cross, what challenges do you see in helping families of veterans with TBI navigate the VA and DOD healthcare systems, and what's the VA doing to help?
Sir, the greatest challenge that we have faced, in my opinion, is communication. It has been so very important for us to make those family members feel and actually be a part of the treatment care team, to be involved in making the decisions that will affect their loved one. We're learning to do that better and better, but this is something that we've really put a great deal of effort in. Communication, I think, is at the core of success, not only in treating the patient himself, but the family as well.
Also, we've heard that mild TBI can go undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. What is VA doing to ensure that veterans with mild TBI are correctly diagnosed? Dr. Cross.
We're working with our primary care providers and all of our staff who deal with polytrauma in any of its forms to make sure that in addition to their education that they already have, their medical education, for instance, that they receive supplemental training to make sure that they understand those fine distinctions, not to just recognize the severe cases, but the mild and moderate as well.
Okay. Why is it that VA is not using the brief traumatic brain injury screen development by the Department of Defense and the Veterans Brain Injury Center to screen veterans for mild TBI?
We're vitally interested in screening. We take great interest in the work that DOD is doing with the screen and the Defense Veterans Brain Injury Center. We want to make sure that any screen that we adopt is evidence-based and applicable to the population, the much larger population that we serve. We're following this with great interest, and we're doing research of our own.
But Colonel Labatta, has a brief traumatic brain injury screen been validated as a screen for mild TBI?
Yes, the screening questions are validated to the point of 80, in the mid 80s, 85% or so type of sensitivity at this time. So we're. Some of those questions have been asked to redeployed returning units and have not been wider applied until we know more about that and to apply them both for more redeployed units and to apply those or modified versions of those questions into the VA system.
So it has been 85% validated. That's a pretty high percentage. So why isn't the VA using it? You're looking for 100%?
We're not looking for 100%. We are looking to make sure that it is applicable to the patient population that we serve. I've read the study that has been referred to. I believe it's one study. And as I said, that we want to make sure that we don't inappropriately label, that we don't expose to imaging studies that are unnecessary. We want to make sure that we have a test that works for our population. Dr. Sickford?
Are you testing it right now?
No, sir. We're doing research on developing tests.
And how long will that be?
We're doing research that we're expecting research grants on those subjects this year.
So you will have some results on that research this year?
I can't promise you that, sir. We will do the research this year.
Okay. I guess, my concern is, and I know Dr. Ritchie made a statement that you have the tools. You might have the tools for those who can access those tools, My concern is talking to a lot of veterans, they do not have access to those tools, and that's a big difference. The tools are no good if a veteran cannot access it. And when and that's my major concern, particularly for veterans that live in rural areas who have even a greater problem of accessing tools. When you look at under the CARES process, a lot of the recommendations have not even been implemented to bring the tools available to the rural areas. So I'm really concerned with that. I'm also very concerned that the VA did not provide the $100 million that Secretary Principe had talked about for fiscal year 2005 for new mental health care efforts, as well as the additional $35 million that VA said that they would be using, and they sent out to the visions. They never stipulated that it was for mental health care areas in which they can use to make up shortfalls in a lot of other different areas. And the other area that I'm really concerned about is the fact that when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and what's happening with them with the TBI and PTSD, and the war over in Iraq and Afghanistan is triggering effects of veterans from Vietnam. And will they be able to get those access, because they might fall into Category 8, because of the current war, it's really having a negative effect on them. And these are a lot of concerns that I have. And when you mention that you have the tools, I beg the difference. Everyone does not have access to those tools, and we are not doing our job to make sure that they are. And I think it's incumbent upon each and every one of us here at this table in Congress, and each and every one of you at that table, to make sure that we provide the services for our veterans. And I realize that you're in a different situation, that you have to get your statements approved. I do not have to get my statements approved, and I can tell you, having heard from veterans yesterday, and having heard from other veterans in the past, Blake Miller, Mrs. Pelkey, who lost her husband to suicide, veterans are not getting the help that they need, and I would implore each and every one of you to do what you have to do to convince your boss and your superiors to do what they have to do to provide the resources so our veterans can get it. Because this is a family values issue. It doesn't affect only the veterans. It affects their families. And if you care about family values and if you care about veterans, you'll do everything in your heart and soul to convince your superiors to do what is right, and that is to take care of the veterans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Michel. Mr. Thorne, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your statement, Mr. Michel. Can anyone there tell me how many suicides we've had from returning Afghanistan, Iraqi troops? I'm sorry, can you speak a little louder?
Sir, I don't have that number with me, but I'll take it for the record and get you that information.
Give me a guess, Mr. Cross. Come on. You don't have it with you. Is it in the thousands? Is it millions? Is it 10? Is it 100? Come on.
Dr. Katz.
We've requested information from the National Death Index, which records...
Nobody there knows how many suicides there have been from returning Iraqi soldiers? Nobody there knows? This is disgraceful. You guys are the experts. Many people have attributed the suicides, not everyone, but the connection between PTSD and suicide is very clear. Surely you would want to know how many suicides there are to see if this is a problem or not.
Perhaps I can answer that question. I believe that the number of suicides in active duty soldiers after they've returned from Iraq is about 78. However, I will need to confirm that exact number.
I've seen higher, much higher estimates. I don't know, you hedged it with active duty. I don't know what that means. I've seen in the hundreds. I've also seen, and if you dispute this, let me know, that the suicide rate is much higher in this population than in either the normal veteran population or the normal civilian population. Is that true or not?
No, the suicide rate actually consistently has been lower in the military than civilian populations that are comparably matched in terms of the age and demographics.
I'm saying the returning Iraqi Afghanistan soldiers. Use my language. You take whatever I say and use your own language, and which gives all kinds of caveats and bureaucratic thing. You said I said one thing, you said the military. That means everybody now in the military, including all the guys at the desks, right? So is the suicide rate of returning Iraqi and Afghanistan soldiers, Marines, and anybody who's involved there, even civilians, higher or not than the general population?
No, sir. Not.
All right. I have different information. I think that's at least a matter of debate. But as I think Colonel Ritchie said, any suicide would be important. Of course, you cloak that concern with all kinds of suicidal events. What the hell is a suicidal event? It's an attempted suicide or a real suicide, probably. But the way you talk about them dehumanizes it. It takes the passion out, takes the emotion out. Okay, let's rate, let's say it's 83. Somebody said 83 earlier. You said 78. I've seen hundreds. Have we done everything we could to prevent those, is what I want to know. Every one of you said what a great job we're doing. I don't question that we're doing a lot. I don't question your own commitment to this. I don't question your own sincerity in this. But you have an opportunity here in front of people who have said their concern and who control the resources that you get. What do you need to do your job better? Tell us. What resources do you need? Not one person has said we need additional resources or we would like to have additional this. You have said everything is fine. Colonel Ritchie said we have all the tools that we need. Everybody else said, oh, we're doing such remarkable things. How come every one of us here, and I'm sure you too, have heard story after story after story that we're not doing our job? Because we are doing part of it, but we're not doing a lot. From who has much, much is asked. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. If we can't devote the resources we need to do these, to take care of every single person who needs the help, we're not doing our job. So what else do you need to do your job? No, not one of you has said that to us. You got some very sympathetic people here. We want to give you resources. What would you do? How would you do your job better? Every one of you, how would you do your job better if you had more resources?
Sir, we are committed to doing the best job that we can.
Oh, come on, Dr. Cross.
Now, first,
tell me what you wanted, what you need to do the job better.
I screen every single patient that we have for depression.
But as Mr. Michaud said, maybe half, we don't know, half the people aren't even coming into you. How do we outreach them? Do you need any more outreach help?
We're making a tremendous effort in outreach.
Oh, shit. I can't believe you guys.
Can I tell you about some of
the... I can't believe you, all of you. We are making remarks. We're doing everything. We're giving you a chance to say what you need. Let's see. We have 150,000 troops in Iraq now. Probably several hundred thousand have come back. Probably another couple hundred thousand are gone. I would say that adds up to maybe 1 million children of families. What are we doing for the children to tell them about PTSD when their daddy comes home and their mommy comes home? What do we tell them about the nightmares that their parents are going to have? What do we tell about why they're being slapped in the face, or why their father tried to kill himself? What are we doing for the children?
Perhaps I can address that one. We've got a number of new educational products, which is part of the solution, but not all of the solution.
You held up a training manual, one of you. Where's the comic book that will help the kids understand what's going
well,
on?
Well, there are those products out there. There's a new Sesame Street video for children of deployed families. There's a new Mr. Poe Goes to War educational product.
Tell me about those. Those sound very interesting. Is everybody given one? How do they get them?
Okay. They are available in a number of sites, Army Community Service.
Does anybody go to the families and deliver
the Army Community Service has been very active in outreach to families, and they're hung on a number of websites.
And everybody who would need this has gotten their hands on it. Would you say that?
No, I would not.
So what would you do to make sure that everybody gets access to it?
Well, I think we're in the process of doing that right now, but we're not there yet.
So what do you need to do the job better? How many times do I have to ask it?
I think, sir, if I could say in my personal opinion,
I know, it's not approved by OMB. That's what I would love to hear.
The area that I'm very concerned about is the family members of the deceased and the family members of the wounded. And the family members of the deceased, in many cases, move off our installations, off our posts. And I think we need to, as a system, continue to do more. Now, the vet centers do offer them counseling through the readjustment centers, but I'm not sure if everybody knows about that. So that is one area where, personally, I think we need to do more over the long term, not just the short term.
Mr. Strong, thank you very much for your question.
Again, your
time's expired.
We're going to have another round, Mr. Chairman?
We'll have another opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Moran, you have a question.
Mr. Brown, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for convening this hearing. I think this topic is one that's of significant importance. I apologize for not hearing your testimony, although I have read, at least in part, your testimony, and I apologize for not hearing the other questions. The reason that I wanted to make certain that I was here was this question in particular. I've been reading the statistics, the press stories of increased post-traumatic stress syndrome, that the numbers are growing in which our servicemen and women are suffering from this condition. My question is there any statistical evidence related to The length of deployment and the number of times that a serviceman or woman is deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan? One of the things that I am greatly concerned about is the request that we're making of our servicemen and women to serve longer and longer periods of time deployed in the war on terror, and the number of times that they are redeployed back to those theaters. And my question is there a relationship between the presence of post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms and the number of employments and the length of deployment?
Yes, sir. In the early part of the war, there were combat units that were from the Army that were rotated into Iraq for varying periods of time. Some were there for less than 6 months. Others were there for long, between 6 months and a year, and others were, in fact, there for longer than a year. Among those, looking at those data, we did see a linear increase in the rate of concerns of post-traumatic stress symptoms and other mental health concerns was increased for those who'd been there longer. Now, in the Army, most units are rotating for a year, so we really can't look at that at this time.
What about the number of deployments? And this is perhaps more National Guard and reserve units, but again, it appears to me that it's true. We're utilizing our Guard and Reserve in significant increases in number of deployments. And I know from time to time that our servicemen and women are returned home. They, in some cases, believe that they have completed their service in theater, and only a matter of few weeks later learn that they are being redeployed. Is there a mental health consequence to that redeployment or that series of redeployments?
We have some data from the post-deployment health reassessment and from some of our other surveys that we've done that actually shows that soldiers who've rotated two or more times to Iraq have similar rates of mental health concerns compared to soldiers who've rotated only one time to Iraq. But that's difficult to study, and that doesn't really answer the question, because we also know that soldiers who've been to Iraq the first time for one rotation have a somewhat higher rate of leaving military service than soldiers who've been, for instance, to Afghanistan or other deployment locations. So there may be a multiple deployment effect that we can't measure because there's a higher rate of attrition from service among those who've been to Iraq.
Well, common sense, at least my common sense, tells me that there would be a relationship, and that being redeployed has to be a significant event in one's life and their family's life with what I would think would be just necessary mental health components to that redeployment.
Sir, if I could add to that, we agree with your interest and concern, and we are looking at that closely. The Army leadership is very interested in that. I mentioned before that we have a mental health advisory team in theater again right now for the fourth time in Iraq, and they are looking at that very issue. The post-deployment health reassessment is looking at that. I expect that we will have more data emerge over time as the multiple deployments continue.
What kind of time frame do you think that you would have more data in which we could better analyze the answer to these questions?
In general, the results of the mental health assessment teams have been coming out yearly. We have the results from the mental health assessment team sometime this fall, the current MHAT-3. The ones from MHAT-4 will probably be next summer or fall, so over time. In addition, we have the results of the post-deployment health reassessment, which is coming out continually. So I would say over the next year, there will be a number of different sources of data.
Anyone else? Thank you very much for your response. I just have a genuine concern about what we're doing to soldiers and their families in today's circumstances they face. And my guess is this is one component, one symptom of the results of multiple deployments long periods of deployment. And any information that you garner in the short run in which it is of value to us in making decisions and encouraging the Department of Defense to do things differently. In other words, sooner knowing that information is better before it's no longer relevant. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Moran. Dr. Snyder, you have questions?
I do. Colonel Ritchie, following up on you're bringing up the family members, and I appreciate you bringing up the family members. If a base and a family, a spouse, get notice, and they're living on the base, that their active duty member has died overseas, what's the time period in terms of notification and having to be out of the housing and off the base?
I believe that the answer to that is 1 year. I would need to double check for you. That doesn't directly fall into the medical lane, but I believe that it used to be 6 months and now is extended to a year.
Because it,
and I'll take that for the record also to confirm.
Because
that.
We talk a lot about the support network, but they lose that support network at some point. Dr. Hogan, you're on page 9 of your written testimony. You say that there are gaps in mental health research. You say, quote, specifically, research is limited in the areas of establishing standardized treatment strategies for combat-related PTSD, long-term longitudinal studies, and studies on the impact of deployments on military families, end of quote. Why is the research limited? Is it, do you all need more medical research dollars from us? Would you benefit from more medical research dollars? Are there, do you have some estimate of how much additional dollars you need, or are there other factors? What's the limitation here?
The I'm only speaking for research within DOD among our soldiers or men and women who are serving. In general, I think we've done a good job with identifying the problems and look and reducing stigma and barriers to care. But I think that there are some there's a potential lack of standardization of the treatment that soldiers receive. In that soldiers really speak need to. There's a way of communicating with soldiers about mental health issues.
No, you're describing a problem, but what's it going to take to solve the problem? I appreciate what you're saying there, but what kind of money or what is it that's keeping you from doing that kind of study?
I hesitate to quote a specific dollar figure because I don't think I'm allowed to do that, but I would take that for the record, and I'd be happy to
provide. We can read the First Amendment to you.
Yeah. What's that?
Colonel, it applies in this building. Without quoting a specific amount, would it be helpful if you had additional dollars?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We really do not have any. We really have very few treatment studies within DOD that's focused specifically on what medications troops should are effective for troops in the combat environment. For instance, what are the best cognitive behavioral techniques that speak the language of the soldiers? And we're doing a lot. We know a lot. We know that pharmacologic interventions are effective. We know that cognitive behavioral therapy are effective. And we rely on a lot of good research studies that have been conducted outside of DOD. But I think more could be done in the area of specific treatment studies for our soldiers, within the military before they leave service.
Thank you. Dr. Cross, in your testimony on page 6, your written testimony, you talk about research collaboration between NIH and DID, and you mentioned 55 proposals were received, that those with merit are expected to start later this year. Of the ones that you considered to have merit, were all of them funded? And again, obviously, it's a bottom line question.
For this year, we plan to fund at least 6 new major scientific projects related to TBI and FY07. Spending for FY07, including research on polytrauma, neurotrauma, amputation, prosthetics, it would estimate to be approximately $75 million.
That wasn't my question. My question was, do you have proposals of these 55 that you – this is your statement. I'm just reading from your statement.
Sure.
You said you have 55 proposals you've received, and that those with merit are expected to start later. Are you saying that – my question is, do you have funding to start all the ones that have merit, or were some of those 55 not able to be started, even though you consider them to have merit because you did not have adequate funding? Could you have benefited from some more research dollars?
We're going to fund them based on their methodology. We're not going to fund them all. Those that meet the criteria that we set, those will the ones that will be funded. I don't know
I
where
should
that
have
line
become
is
a
be
dentist.
Drawn yet.
Sometimes you have to pull teeth around here, don't you? I mean,
sir, honestly, I don't know where the line is going to be drawn on that in terms of the methodology.
By methodology, is money part of your methodology? Is that on your?
Absolutely.
I mean, we've had previous testimony. This is not a mystery. We've had previous testimony here that there was not enough. In fact, it was in somebody's written statement from the VA, I think. Was it from the VA that there was not enough money to fund all the traumatic brain injury studies? And that was several months ago, and I'm just trying to get a follow-up. We can't help you if we don't have information.
I have with me Dr. Cooper Smith, who is heading our research effort, if I could introduce him at this moment.
We often have a category of meritorious but not funded. I don't have the numbers for you on that particular review. Our general funding rate is about 20% to 25%, and that's where we, target the meritorious proposals. We work with the people who are below those levels to try to upgrade their proposals, usually, and we review them on the next round. But I don't know in that particular review whether there was a category of meritorious but not funded. I'll get that information.
Yeah, we like it. The lights on. We've had previous testimony to that effect, that there more work, good work could have been done if there was adequate funding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Snyder. And we will entertain a second round of questions, and then I've got a question to Dr. Hogue. Is it often reported that 30% of service members returning from Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from PTSD? That is an alarming statistic.
This is a good question.
As a recognized leader in research in this area, what do you think this is true incident rate of PTSD among those returning from OEF or OIF?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question, sir, the last part of your question.
Is 30% the right number, or is there some other number?
30% is certainly the right number, at least for individuals who experience symptoms. But in terms of but that doesn't mean that they have the disorder of PTSD. Our estimates, based on a variety of data sources, is that about 10% to 15% of soldiers who return from Iraq have the disorder of PTSD and need treatment. And then there are additional soldiers who experience symptoms to a varying degree, that may need some assistance but don't necessarily reach the criteria for actually having the disorder.
And if I could add to that, by symptoms, what we're seeing very commonly is hypervigilance, the increased arousal, nightmares, and sort of just being on edge all the time. And that should, in most cases, resolve on its own over time. The message we're trying to put out to our troops and our leaders is if that doesn't resolve, if it gets in your way with either your family life or your work life, come in and see us. And us, we include as chaplains, behavioral health, primary care, military one source. So we try to offer a really wide range of options, low stigma ways that people can come and get the help they need. In many cases, just the education that this is normal is helpful to the soldier. I'd like to add, too, that I think an important push for us that we're doing right now with the aid of Colonel Hogue and his troops is battle mind training for spouses and family members and parents of soldiers. How can we make sure they're educated in these symptoms? I had a mother of a soldier tell me very eloquently how shocked she was when her son came home for R&R and he was just not acting right, and she felt that she needed more education on that issue to realize that her son might not be a very nice guy when he came back for the R&R. So that again is part of our increased educational effort to the whole collective military family.
Do you find that most of the cases coming back, are they treated with medicine, or are they just by coming back in and having the community support and the family support that tends to help them overcome that that stress?
I think community support is absolutely essential. I do not have hard data for you on that, but anecdotally, it makes a lot of difference to have the uniform be recognized, to have people be thanked for their service. Tremendously important.
Then what percent would you say would have to be treated with some medicine or...
I think the question is what percent need to be treated? Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir. I know there's all sorts of treatments, and I guess going having sessions, but I'm just thinking
among,
if there's some long-lasting treatment that would have to be on some,
Among the soldiers who've come back from Iraq, about a third have received some sort of mental health evaluation or treatment. A lot of this is preventive, educational-type services and not necessarily treatment for disorders. About 12% of the troops who've come back from Iraq have been diagnosed with some sort of mental health problem. That's within the year of return and within our military treatment facilities. Once they leave the military and go into the VA system, I think the VA has data as well on what percent of individuals who access the healthcare system at the VA receive a diagnosis of a mental health problem or a presumptive diagnosis of a mental health problem. And their overall, the data that I've seen that's been made public, the overall rate of accessing care for mental health issues actually is fairly similar, though there's a lot higher use of mental health diagnoses. I don't know if that's clear, but it's about a third of individuals access care, and somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 10% receiving a diagnosis of a mental health problem within the first year of coming home.
Dr. Cross, is that a similar number with you? I'm really just looking to see how many are long-term users of some kind of corrective medicine.
Our battle mind technique that has been brought forward by DOD. We have adopted this. We're using it in our vet centers. We're finding it to be very practical and very effective. And I want to thank my DOD colleagues for their work on that. And I'll ask Dr. Katz to respond to your specific question.
Thanks. Okay. Dr. Katz.
In terms of the number of people we're seeing, a VA sees about 31% or so of returning veterans. About a third of them have mental health concerns or diagnoses. 15% have PTSD. Other conditions, as Dr. Hope suggested, like depression, anxiety, alcohol use problems are also common. information from our National Center for PTSD suggests that among those exposed to a significant trauma in military or civilian life, about 25% will exhibit significant symptoms over time. Most of them, though, will recover on their own or with brief interventions. About 8 to 10% will require more extended treatment, and about 60% of those that receive either medications, certain antidepressants, for example, or certain forms of psychotherapy will respond.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Michaud, you got a follow-up question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens to, I guess, Dr. Cross, what happens to the mental health care initiatives that are supposed to be beefed up VA resources for mental health care when the allocated funds sunset? What happens to those initiatives? And when does it sunset?
The enhancement funds, I believe you're talking about the enhancement funds?
Yes.
We're still fully committed to using the full amount of those enhancement funds. Here's what we're doing. We want to make sure that every one of those dollars that we're put forward for that is used appropriately. It's taking a bit longer to do that, but we want to make sure that those dollars go to the very best purpose to actually make a difference for each of those veterans. So we're doing this carefully. We are taking some time, but we're doing it as expeditiously as we can while making sure that it's used very effectively.
So when those funds sunset, what happens to the initiatives you're going to request, when does it sunset?
We've been talking about await funding. We can't speak about funding until you speak about funding. I was hired 4 months ago to implement the strategic plan and empowered to do it. We will do it. Programs are out there, but it's more than spending money. Implementing the strategic plan really involves culture change. Issues like the Dr. Ritchie and Dr. Hoag were talking about, integrating mental health in primary care, is a matter of money, but not just a matter of money. Reorienting the specialty mental health sector to provide rehabilitation and recovery-oriented oriented care is a matter of cultural change that we're working intensively on. It will be done, but it will take time.
Okay. Okay, actually, I just told that once the money runs out, then the facilities will have to pick up.
Yes. One of the conditions of the money going to a facility or a VISN, a regional network, is a commitment that staff hired will be permanent staff, and when designated funds run out, if they do, the programs and the positions will be continued by the facilities or the VISN.
So if a VISN is running low on money and they see this program, then they probably will not want to accept it, knowing that they'll have to pick up the cost.
Sir, for the VISNs on mental health, we're putting out enough money to make sure that they can carry out whatever program they need to carry out. Looking at 05 to 06 and on to 07, we're looking at a 29.1, about 30% increase in funding for that period of time. The service enhancements are going to make a difference. We are going to carry them out. We are going to do good things for these veterans. And we're going to make sure that those programs that we fund are actually effective and make a difference.
Yeah. I respectfully disagree, because I know some visions that are supposed to have a CBOC within the vision, they refuse to submit a business plan because they know they don't have the money to implement it. So I can't see them doing this. What steps is the VA taking now to be able to handle, to be able to release funds quickly for the new mental health initiatives for 07? Are you doing anything now for the 07?
Sir, we've already got a great deal of work done. We're working on a mental health primary care initiative. You talked about stigma. We want to make sure that that is not an issue. People are comfortable in coming into usually a primary care facility and seeing people that they already know. What we want to do is to make sure that when we do detect any mental health condition, especially things like depression, we want to make sure that when we detect it, that we then follow through and have the capability in those primary care clinics. So we have brought forward a mental health primary care initiative that's going to expend, on which we're going to expend very substantial funds over the coming years.
Then last question is, how many and how much?
Our talk about the primary care initiative is roughly a $40 million program. We received 85 responses to requests for proposal, and will be funding the overwhelming majority of them. Other plans for the year are to target specific needs, both in established programs where there are gaps and also in new programs. For example, part of our plan for the year includes suicide prevention counselors, very much like the ones that Mr. Boswell spoke about. Another plan is to put recovery and rehabilitation coordinators in the field, really to facilitate at the local level the transformation that's discussed in the strategic plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issues surrounding brain rehabilitation, traumatic brain injury, what's the status of the ability for Bethesda and Walter Reed Army Medical Center to meet those needs of our military men and women? Do we have sufficient capacity?
Right now, do we have the capacity to meet the rehabilitation needs at Walter Reed and National Naval Medical Center?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We could certainly do more inpatient rehab at both those facilities for traumatic brain injury. I think that when we have a soldier there who's had a brain injury and is there for prosthetic care for a year and also had a brain injury, the prosthetic care and the prosthetic rehab seems to take first place. When there isn't another injury, what we usually do is try to have that soldier transferred to one of the VA polytrauma centers where they have active traumatic brain injury rehab. So there is, to hopefully answer one of the questions of what is a need, there is a gap, if you will, for those soldiers who need some inpatient rehab during their acute care, while they're getting acute care at the MTFs, at the...
Is that gap caused by lack of dollars, lack of personnel, or lack of physical space?
All the above.
I think the answer to that question, sir, would be yes.
And I guess also what you're telling me, though, is in order to, aside from the inpatient treatment that's occurring during the immediate return and medical care and treatment at Bethesda or the Naval Academy, Walter Reed, thank you, then we are utilizing the VA system to help meet that gap in other circumstances?
Yes, sir.
And the capacity within the VA?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
And is there sufficient capacity within the VA for this treatment?
Sir, looking at our polytrauma treatment centers, the four of them, 12 beds each, occupancy rate about 71%.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Moran.
Mr. Fielder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having this hearing today. I think it's very important to our nation. I'm not going to get too much, I can tell, with questions. Let me just briefly say I'm more than a little disappointed from the testimony today. I said in my opening statement that we're letting our veterans down. That judgment is based on representing San Diego, California, probably the biggest military and veterans community in the country, if not the biggest, one of the biggest. And I talk to my constituents every day. We had a lot of statistics from Dr. Katz. I appreciate that. But I assume those statistics are based on the patients that come in. I mean, two-thirds of the almost 600,000 returnees from Iraq and Afghanistan don't access that system. So I'm not sure whatever your statistics are, we're missing an incredible amount of our population. And what saddens me is that we have the expertise, and I don't question your expertise, we have the expertise and the resources not to let these young men and women, some older men and women, down. We know that, whatever your statistics say, the Guard and the Reserve forces who are taking a much more prominent role, as you know, in this war, when they get those papers that they have to check boxes on, all they want to do is get home. And they can check anything that stops that. And if they have to go for a medical inquiry for 2 or 3 days, they ain't going to check that box. And they're going to have those problems. Treating our veterans, as you know, should be seen as a cost of the war. We're spending $1 billion every 2.5 days in Iraq. If we can't take the money that you all need to do your job better, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. We have the money. And Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to maybe you and some of the other leaders of the committee could talk to their bosses. I hope they talk to their bosses. Talk to the Secretary of Defense. Talk to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The rules under which you're here and the kind of statements that you're allowed to make are not helping our veterans. Personally, I know you want to help them. You're not doing it with this kind of testimony and the way you've responded to our questions. You are simply not doing the job that you can do. And if we have to change the rules, Mr. Chairman, and make those arrangements with their secretaries, we ought to do that. These people know a lot more, need a lot more than they're telling us here. And you've lost an opportunity for our veterans. We've lost an opportunity to use your expertise. That saddens me. I wish we could find a way to talk more freely. Because, as Dr. Katz says, you know, we have the money. You have the expertise. Let's join those two together. We want to give you the money. We want to make your arguments, but you're not helping us. And I wish you could find a way to do that in a better way. I thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fielder. Mr. Michaud, for a brief statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, once again for having this hearing. I also want to thank the panel as well for your willingness to come here. And look forward to working with you. I want to thank Mr. Fielder as well. And in closing, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say, and that actually Mr. Fielder's remark actually reminded me, yesterday we actually heard from two veterans that came back from Iraq, and one of them exactly, and how they answered the question made a difference of whether or not they got home immediately or not. So it forced them to answer the question in a way that they can go home to see their loved ones. So there is problems out there, and as Mr. Fielder mentioned and others, hopefully that each and every one of you will look down deep in your heart and really, because I know you know what's going on out there, and encourage your bosses to come forward and put forward an aggressive program that is funded. You have the tools, but we got to make sure that each and every veteran has access to those tools, and that you don't have to wait for services. So once again, I want to thank the panel for coming today, and thank you especially, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw, and let me tell you, I want to thank you and Mr. Field and the other members for their participation today, and certainly thank the panel for what you do with the resources that's available to you for solving, you know, such a pressing problem that we feel like that we need to reach across all lines to help our young men and women in their time of need. Without further ado, I'd like to ask unanimous consent that all members have 5 legislative days in which to submit an opening statement or to revise and extend their remarks. And without nothing further, the hearing stands adjourned, and thanks to you all again for your service.